things we're doing without Congress are making a difference, but we could do so much more if Congress would just come on and help out a little bit. Just come on. Come on and help out a little bit. Stop being mad all the time. Stop just hating all the time. Come on. Let's get some work done together.
President Obama talking to a friendly crowd earlier this week in Kansas City. Well, House Republicans are expected to do something today, vote on two immigration bills. One is aimed at the surge of immigrants coming to the United States from Central America. The other would pave the way for deporting 500,000 people brought here as children. The two bills came after a major power struggle between rank-and-file Republicans and Tea Party conservatives yesterday. And here to give us the latest on all this drama is Derek Wallbank. He covers the House for Bloomberg News. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Well, how are you? More importantly, you're in the midst of it. So tell us exactly what they are voting on today and how is it different from what was on the table yesterday?
Sure. Well, they are voting on a pair of bills. One of them is going to try and reverse parts of the president's deferred action for childhood arrivals thing. That's the executive order that he made to sort of slow or deprioritize deportations for those Dreamer kids who came here as children. And the other one is a supplemental appropriations bill that is far less than what President Obama asked for to deal with the continuing crisis of children coming to the southern border from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. It is tacked on with policy provisions that the White House says that they don't like at all. And all of that is speeding up to a showdown vote possibly later today that House Republicans are still trying to round up the votes to get on a bill that is going exactly nowhere.
Exactly nowhere because the Senate has left already and won't
vote on it. Exactly nowhere because the Senate has left and President Obama threatened to veto the bill by my count 32 minutes after the bill text was filed.
Okay, so this would appropriate $659 million versus the president's ask of $3.7 billion. And it was pretty much dead yesterday. So what happened?
It was dead yesterday, and it's a really interesting thing. I mean, they House Republicans gave up. They told all of their members, sorry, we're going to vote on a highway patch. Go home. There were lawmakers who had made it to the airport. Ileana Ross-Layton, who represents Miami, had gotten her frequent flyer upgrade to first class and was all excited about that. Another member was actually in line boarding when they got the call, no, come back from the airport, we're going to try again. This led to a series of showdown meetings. This morning, they added another $35 million for the National Guard. And they're tweaking the policy provisions, and the whole goal is to get folks like Steve King and Michelle Bachmann from that Tea Party wing of the conference to come on board. Nancy Pelosi said, and Barack Obama just reiterated live on air, that this basically took what Democrats saw as a bad bill and made it worse. It looks like a lot of the Democrats who were supporting, there were only really about 10 or so, are going to cleave off. And the question now is, do you pick up enough Republicans that you can get to passage on your own without having to count on a single Democrat? Because that might actually be what you're looking at.
But this last-minute change of plans happened only after two senators got involved, Ted Cruz from Texas and Jeff Sessions from Alabama. How did that happen, and why were they so influential on the House?
Well, Ted Cruz has had a lot of influence on a certain number of House Republicans, although there's some question about whether or not it's Ted Cruz pulling the strings of a marionette or if it's just people who happen to agree with each other enjoying Dr. Pepper and pizza in Ted Cruz's office. And I think both sides would tell you it's a little bit more of the latter. They met actually over Dr. Pepper and pizza in Ted Cruz's office earlier this week to talk, and that hardened the resolve of a lot of people. Jeff Sessions of Alabama was saying that he couldn't support parts of it, that he thought that the border bill didn't really solve the problem. And that's been a key message from some of these Republicans who say that the whole problem on the southern border is President Obama's what they say, open-ended invitation to children to come to America and not get deported. There's obviously significant question about whether that is entirely or how much that contributes. Setting that aside, that's what they believe. And so there is an open question of, if you don't deal with this, with this executive order that Obama issued in 2012, do you actually solve the problem? And so that's why they have been keen to force a vote later today on that provision. And right now, that's going ahead.
That's going ahead, despite the fact that there are moderate Republicans that don't want that to go ahead, that they actually like the Deferred Action for Child Arrivals program that the president put in place. Maybe they don't like how he put it in place, but they say they do like it.
And this is, you know, this is a big risk for Republicans, really. You are moving rightward to try and pass this. This is one of those things that, that Republicans were saying in their last leadership shuffle after Eric Cantor got defeated by a Tea Party insurgent opponent. And the shuffle was going on. One of the things that people were campaigning on is a need to try and get all the Republicans around a bill. What that's done in this practice is it said, we want to get to a majority of the House just from Republicans on this legislation. That is a very high bar, and it means that a lot of people who are deeply distrustful of leadership have to be brought on board. In no part has anybody picked up the phone and called Nancy Pelosi and said, what do you think? How can we get some of your folks on board? That's just not, we're not playing that game. This is a bid to get Republicans on the same page and be able to leave for the August break having passed something.
So what does this say about the new House Majority Leader from California, Kevin McCarthy?
Well, yesterday, every single headline yesterday night and this morning was not so good for Mr. McCarthy and Steve Scalise from Louisiana, his new whip. They are trying to salvage this. I actually talked to McCarthy this morning, and they're saying, look, this is a collaborative process, that these things don't necessarily come easy, and that at the end of the day, they will get around to a good position. One thing that they have done that's really interesting here, and I need to flag, is that they've also given themselves room. They are putting together, they put together a rule that will allow the House to bring up border-related legislation in one single day, any time from now through the start of September. And that means that if Homeland Security actually runs out of money, if they have to call back the House, they can move quickly. So they've put themselves in position, if there is an emergency in terms of funding, they can come back and do something. Leadership folks are reluctantly kind of conceding that this has been a complete mess in how we got here, but they're hopeful that at about dinner time, Eastern time, they will have actually gotten themselves around to a politically tenable position.
So it really is just about politics and not actually solving the immigration problem.
It's hard to solve something that's not going to get enacted into law. And this is one of the difficult things that you have with immigration. Immigration is turning into a bit of a third rail. This is incredibly hard to pass. You have hanging over all of this the prospects of a possible Republican Senate, where Republicans think they'll get a better deal on whatever they want to do. Republicans at a leadership level are still convinced that they have to do something before the 2016 election on immigration. In terms of 2014, that's not going to happen. Everybody's conceded that that's not going to happen. And this is an object lesson in how difficult anything to do with immigration will wind up being at any point, full stop, especially if your coalition is going to be 218 people from just one political party.
Derek Welbank covers the House for Bloomberg. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Okay, so now let's take a look at what this Congress has actually managed to accomplish, or not, as the case may be. Ben Pershing is Washington editor for the National Journal. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Okay, so let's get to what was actually accomplished. It's a short list, but maybe you could go over it. And it includes money for transportation projects and revamping the VA.
That's true. Those are both things that just got done in the last 24 hours, actually, although even those, I think some people would argue, were much harder than they needed to be, took longer, involved more fighting, and maybe were less ambitious than they could have been if the two parties had been willing to work together.
So why is it just taking transportation? This is something that had bipartisan support. Why was it so difficult to get that accomplished?
Well, a couple things. One is how to pay for it. There were big disagreements about where to find this money to fill up the fund that pays for transportation projects all over the country. Normally, that's funded by gas taxes, but that's been running out of money, so they had to take money from sort of the general treasury. But there was a lot of disagreement about how much to take. And there was also a big disagreement about how long to make this bill last through. The Senate and Democrats only wanted to patch it through December, come back in December and do a bigger bill to really figure out how to pay for highway funds. Republicans preferred to do it through next May, and that's what ended up happening. They sort of got their way on that one. But, you know, neither of those suggestions is perfect. You know, the transportation industry, which would much rather have a system in place for years where they know exactly how much money they have and for how long.
Okay, and what about the VA reform bill? That has some substantive points in it, I understand.
It does. And, you know, and this is a real, you know, issue that of bipartisan concern. There have been a lot of coverage of problems within the Veterans Administration, long wait times, inability of veterans to get medical appointments. So there was real incentive for both sides to get something done. And they did get something done substantive. It was just more an issue. I think a lot of people thought it would have happened more quickly than it did, especially, you know, everyone agrees that veterans need help. And so if there was anything you would have thought could have brought the parties together, this was it.
Okay, so in a news conference today, the president was really frustrated with Congress and the fact that he can't get anything through that he needs to get through, including the approval of ambassadors. I mean, there was this problem over approving the ambassador to Russia during this crisis with Ukraine. And so what is happening that the Senate, which is in Democratic control, cannot approve his ambassador appointments?
Well, there are two things here, and it's a question of which side you feel like blaming. Earlier this Congress, Senate Democrats decided to change the rules there, the traditions for how many votes you need to move these nominations forward. And their argument was that Republicans were really just obstructing every nominee. They were forcing a 60-vote margin in order to get these three people through, a 60-vote majority. And it was impossible to get because Republicans wouldn't agree. So Democrats changed that to 51. In order to get things going more quickly. And Republicans were so angry about that they just decided to delay everything as much as they could. So you have nominees that are taking a very, very long time to get through. And it is frustrating for the president. It's frustrating for a lot of people in the administration. The question is, you know, you can blame both sides for this depending on who you think is right. The bottom line is they can't agree. And that's why these things are moving so slowly.
Right. And they can't even agree on whether or not it's one side or the other calling for impeaching the president or talking about impeaching the president, I should say. And that talk has been going on in Capitol Hill. What's happening?
That's true. You know, this is an issue that's pretty much all talk and no substance. It's true that there have been some rank and file Republican members of Congress, a few of them, and some people off the Hill who are Republican voices who've called for impeaching the president. But the vast majority of Republicans in Congress think that's a bad idea. The leadership of Republicans in Congress thinks that's a very bad idea. And their argument is Democrats are very happy to have this talk out there because, it makes Republicans look bad, and B, it helps Democrats raise money and fire up their base. So to some extent, this is sort of a creation of Democrats who want this to be a bigger deal than it is. That doesn't mean that no Republicans have talked about it, because they have, but it does mean that Democrats have sort of amplified it for their own political benefit.
And impeaching as well as suing the president.
Yeah, well, that's a bit more real. The House actually did approve a resolution that authorizes the House to file suit against the president, arguing that he's exceeded his authority under the law, that he's done things that only Congress can do. It's a real question mark how far this will go. There are some legal experts who say the House is within its authority to file this lawsuit. There are also plenty of other legal experts who say, you know, the House has no standing here. This case isn't going anywhere. So we'll have to watch and see.
But this really does get at the nucleus of the problem in Washington, which the president talked about today during this news conference, and that is the inability for any of his projects that he wants to get happening to get through Congress. And so he has to take this alternative route, and then that then stirs up the anger and the talk of suing the president.
That's certainly true. You know, Congress doesn't get anything done. Obama says he'll take it into his own hands. And then Republicans say, you know, this is the imperial presidency. You know, there's some question. there are Republicans who don't think the president should do these things, and that on a basic level, when it comes to philosophy, the government doing less is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, and that the idea that the president has to leap in and take all this authority is not necessarily how it's supposed to work. So it's been an interesting display of the two sides' beliefs and how big the government should be.
Ben Pershing, Washington editor for the National Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, what do you want Congress to work on? Is there an issue that you think should get top billing that is being ignored? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page. Coming up, the gene that regulates stress does not work as well in people prone to suicidal thoughts. This discovery could lead to a simple blood test that identifies people at risk of suicide. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, imagine being able to prevent just one of the roughly 40,000 suicides that occur every year in this country. That possibility is a little closer to reality thanks to a new study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. The study looked at a gene that helps regulate cortisol, the stress hormone, and found some people who committed suicide had a mutated version of this gene. This could lead to a suicide blood test. Could, I should stress. Zachary Kaminsky, the lead author of the study, joins us now. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madeline. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Let's start with this gene. It's called SKA2. And typically, what does this gene do?
Well, there's not too much that's known about this gene. We've sort of identified it as a new player. But what is known is that it seems to be important for a gene pathway that we know is involved in regulating stress, which makes a lot of sense when we're thinking about suicide. What we think this gene does specifically is it acts as a chaperone for the stress hormone receptor to get it into the nucleus. And why the nucleus of the cell, and why we need that to happen is that is there to shut down the stress response. So under normal circumstances, when we get stressed out, our bodies will flood with the stress hormone, cortisol, and it's this system that's responsible for, of course, after that stress, to shut it down. But what we think is going on here is that the lower levels of SKA2 that we've identified would cause this stress hormone receptor not to do its job properly. And as a result, we might not be shutting down the stress response in adequate ways. And this would be consistent with a lot of research that's come before in terms of what happens to stress response in individuals at risk for suicide.
So you found that there's this link between a mutated version of SKA or SKA2 gene and elevated levels of cortisol. And how did you discover the link?
Well, the first thing we did actually was to look at the DNA across the entire genome. We didn't know where we were looking, so we used an exploratory technique called a microarray. And we were looking, basically, at a molecular mark that acts like a light switch. And that's ultimately what we're talking about. We're talking about one of these switches that acts a bit like a dimmer to turn up or down levels of a particular gene. So we had some postmortem brain tissue from individuals who had died by suicide and those who hadn't. And we're asking the question, using this technology, are any light switches turned off between individuals who committed suicide and those who hadn't? And SKA2 really jumped to the top. It was one of the few genes that really showed up as what we call highly significant. And when we looked into what it does, we started to become interested in following it further based on what I was talking about earlier in terms of its role in stress.
And then, as I understand it, the other part of the study involved a blood test, blood testing a sample population. Can you talk about that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, so when this popped up as interesting, of course, you know, we have to be skeptical. So we set about asking, can we find this elsewhere? Can we find this in other groups of people? And the first thing before we went to blood is we looked in other groups of brain tissue samples, and we kept finding it. So then we asked, can we get lucky? Can we find this in blood? Because, of course, you know, when it comes to trying to to have a diagnostic tool, you know, you can't sample the brain. You have to be able to have access to the blood. And so we looked in the blood of individuals who had reported having suicidal thoughts, or what we call suicidal ideation. And we also had some information on whether individuals had attempted suicide. Looking for this mark, we found the same change, the same dimmer switch, the same molecular mark was turning down levels of the gene in the blood. So we started to get really excited. We next reasoned that, okay, if this effect can be found in the blood, can we create a statistical model where all we know is the level of this dimmer switch and some other important factors like age and sex, that sort of thing, and can we try to guess who will be experiencing suicidal thoughts? And the answer was a bit surprising how well this worked. It appeared to work with over 80% accuracy.
So the suicidal thoughts come well after the need for the stress hormone. Is that the idea? That during this fight or flight response that cortisol excites, that suicidal ideation doesn't necessarily occur, but it's in the aftermath?
Yeah, I mean, so it's difficult to say exactly what creates a suicidal thought. We, you know, there hasn't been that much work in terms of really pinpointing it down. But what we do know is that when this system is dysregulated, areas of the cortex, or a part of our brain that act a bit like a brake pad for slowing down the more basal fear centers of the brain, these brakes sort of start to diminish, and the fear centers of the brain sort of get excited. So what we're thinking is that this could possibly result in a dysregulated stress response. And one of the important things to keep in mind is what we really think is going on is that with less SCA2, what we have is a vulnerability to stress. It's not necessarily the case that if you have this dimmer switch mark, you're going to be thinking suicidal thoughts. Our model showed that an individual had to have reported stress in order for us to get this good prediction. So we think of it like a pair of failing brake pads, for example, in a car. If you've got less SCA2, you've got, you know, faulty brake pads. And so if you're not stressed, it's like having your car parked in the driveway. You're not going to know that your brakes are bad until you get stressed, until you start driving. And then you're going to notice that something's wrong. It's out of control.
And is this chronic stress? Is this an intense stress, or is it just like daily living, I'm in a traffic jam stress?
Yeah, I mean, so that's difficult to answer. Of course, you know, from day to day, these are some of the things that we're going to have to study more. Our study basically showed that it worked with various metrics that were measured by psychological scales. One of them was the perceived stress scale. So that number that we got from measuring it in people showed that with the higher the level of perceived stress, right? Because we don't all experience stress the same way. What's stressful for one person may be a piece of cake for another. So it looked like with higher perceived stress, this was really putting people at risk if they had the low levels of the SCA2. One thing I really want to stress for anybody listening is that this test is not currently clinically available. It's not something the general public can get their hands on. It's really something that represents a first promising mark on the way towards developing a test. But it's not something that we could call up and get from our doctors.
So conceivably, though, it's possible in the future you could just have a simple blood test to see whether or not you are at risk. And then how would you use that in a clinical setting?
Yeah, so indeed, that is the idea, that hopefully if this continues to work, and, you know, we plan to do more research on larger groups of people to really, you know, make sure that this is working in a reliable way. But how could it be used? Well, we've envisioned sort of a few scenarios. One would be to try to augment what clinicians are doing already. Clinicians are already trying to screen for suicide risk, especially in psychiatric scenarios. And a test like this could be used to try to get a molecular reading of what we're basically you know, asking questions to try to figure out now. So that's one way. The other way that we've thought about that could be efficacious is essentially trying to scan in military populations. I talked a lot about stress and the stress response, and of course, we know that military active engagement situations are highly stressful, and we also know that suicide rates are higher in returning veterans. So I think that scanning for individuals possibly in this population could help identify people in need of intervention.
Zachary Kaminsky, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, if there was a blood test available, would you get it? Would you want to know if you had this gene mutation? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Leave us a voicemail, and we may play what you say on the air at the end of the show. Coming up, James Brown does a new biopic do him justice, and Guardians of the Galaxy worth your movie dollar? Our critics weigh in on the latest new releases after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Today's movie roundup, things will blow up, blockbuster style, and you may or may not want to get on up. Matt Achety is editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Hi.
Thank you. Hi. Good to see
you. And nice to see you. And Christian Harloff, co-host of the Schmoes No. It's hard to say that.
Schmoes No?
Co-host
of the Schmoes No. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of O's.
And AMC, yeah.
And AMC. Okay, well, welcome both of you.
Thank you.
And as promised, blockbuster time. Let's take a listen to Guardians of the Galaxy out today.
We have to stop Ronan.
How? I have a plan.
You've got a plan.
Yes.
First of all, you're copying me from when I said I had a plan.
No, I'm not. People say that all the time. It's not that unique of a thing to say.
Secondly, I don't even believe you have a plan.
I have part of a plan.
Okay, the plan being that Marvel is going to exploit every single comic book, no matter how obscure, into a movie franchise.
Yeah, listen, what I liked about this movie, and I really did enjoy this film, you don't have to be a comic book fan to enjoy this movie. You don't have to be a Marvel Universe fan to enjoy this movie. It's just a space opera. It's a lot of fun. The chemistry between the actors is what really makes this movie work. I had a couple problems with it, but overall, it was a fun time to wind down the summer action series, and Chris Pratt was just really enjoyable as Star-Lord.
Matt?
I like this movie a lot, too. And Christian's right. You know, it's not perfect, but there's the chemistry between the characters really sells it. And I would say if you haven't watched any of the Marvel movies or you're thinking, oh, I don't like comic books, these guys are so off the radar right. for everyone that you're kind of just, if you like sci-fi adventure or even these actors, if you like Chris Pratt, that's Bradley Cooper, who we heard in that argument as a talking raccoon, who is awesome.
He's the best part of the whole
yeah.
movie.
Yeah, Vin Diesel plays this tree that talks and all he says the whole movie is, I am Groot.
I am Groot.
Yeah, this movie is great. It's super fun. Director James Gunn has added, you know, I would say an infectious joy here. Mm-hmm. He's having so much fun and the cast is having fun that it shows. And as a viewer, you kind of have fun and you're willing to go along with it.
And it's also nice to see that they're going to be able to do a new franchise like Matt and I said before that you won't be lost in because you're going to see Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and 3. This movie's going to do very well and it could tie into those other movies that you like if you are a fan of those other movies. Mm-hmm. So if I was going to give a criticism on it, I would say that I would have liked to seen some of the characters developed a little more. I thought Chris Pratt's character was developed really well, but the other ones were just kind of lost because they relied so much on the chemistry, but it's a very fun time at the movies.
Speaking of Chris Pratt, let's talk about his evolution into an action star. I mean, this was a guy who was a schlub on Parks and Recreation, and now he's got the six-pack abs. What's happening with him?
Money, paychecks.
Right. Well, he jokes about getting the call to be this character, and he's like, honey, I got to lose 70 pounds. Stop baking the cookies.
Yeah, apparently he's gained a lot of it back, though, since they went, and he said his wife isn't happy about it, is what he said. But, yeah, this guy's talented, man. I mean, super talented. He's just got that thing. It's that star power.
Yeah, I would say that we're seeing someone, he doesn't necessarily bring the drama to the table that, say, a Bruce Willis does, but I would say that we're seeing someone who is kind of in that same zone. This is a guy who can do action but is very funny, and I think seeing action stars and leading men who can do that level of comedy is a rarity, and I think we're going to see a lot more out of him going forward.
Agreed.
Okay, let's move on to a much smaller movie out this weekend. It's Calvary, and here is a little clip from it.
There's no point in killing a bad priest, but killing a good one, that'd be a shock.
Could have a word.
I hope we don't get locked in here. We'll have to make love to keep warm.
Okay, Matt, you of the tomato meter, yes. What are critics saying about this?
I have to say, I haven't had a chance to see it this yet, but I'm going this weekend. The critics love it. 88% of the critics on our site like this movie. We're calling it Certified Fresh. This is a story. Brendan Gleeson plays this priest in Ireland in a small town who, in a confessional, is told that he's going to be killed. And it starts off this darkly comic thriller. This is from the same director, John Michael McDonough, who directed him in The Guard, which was another smaller release from a couple years back that Brendan Gleeson starred opposite Don Cheadle. And I would say both of these movies are worth seeking out. There's a great supporting cast here. Chris O'Dowd, M. Emmett Walsh, Aidan Gillen, who people will know from Game of Thrones. Right. Again, my plan is to go see it this weekend, so I hope to see people there.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but we were just talking about Braveheart off air, and I've been a fan of Brendan Gleeson for a very long time. I can watch that guy drink a soda can for 2 hours and be fine with it. So this is a movie I want to see as well. It's just a matter of when I can see it.
Okay, so there are, and that's the smallest movie coming out this weekend, right? And there's another big release, and this is the James Brown biopic, Get On Up.
What exactly do you call your style of music?
Well, I call it James Brown music, because it's so far ahead of its time. They ain't got a name for it yet. Take another record. Any record you got on your box at home, it ain't gonna sound like mine. Not even my own old record sound like this new bag. It's like Tidal say, Papa's got a brand new bag.
So he really captures the voice, that gravelly voice.
And he does it in a way, it's not like a impression you see on Saturday Night Live. Like, he is James Brown.
Right. Eddie Murphy doing James Brown Hot Tub Party.
Although I thought about Eddie Murphy a couple times when he was singing throughout the movie. But, I mean, Chadwick Boseman is something else, man. He is so good as James Brown and embodies everything that the Godfather of Soul was. You go to this movie the same way you did to watch James Brown to speak and captured by great performance. That's what this movie is. There are a lot of problems with this film. Echoing kind of what I said about Guardians, there are a lot of story elements that didn't tie up for me in this. Like, James Brown had a dark past as well.
Yes,
a lot of
he
things
did.
That happened. Mm-hmm. They touch on it here and there, and when they do, you want to see where it's going next, and it just kind of drops out. I thought that Tate Taylor, who directed the film, did a lot of ambitious stuff, that really cool stuff throughout the movie in his editing style from how he pieced it together, which I liked, but there were sometimes just didn't deliver all the way. But that really is not why you see this movie. You see this movie because what Chadwick Boseman does. He's awesome.
But do you ever stop thinking this guy is turning in a great performance and just be in it and
you do,
think that
actually,
you're watching James Brown?
Yes. You mentioned his voice. It's the moves. I mean, there are sequences they capture the sequence or part of the sequence, that 18-minute performance from the Tammy show that was done here in Santa Monica way back when. They do the performance at the Apollo. They do the performance in Paris. And you forget that you're watching someone play James Brown. You know, it's not just the voice. Boseman has those moves. The physicality he brings to this role. I had moments where I thought, God, I wonder if they're just digitizing his face onto existing footage.
Wow.
It's uncanny. Yeah. It's really kind of shocking. Look, it is kind of hard to take the biopic seriously these days because it's kind of cliched. At least they mix things up a little bit here. And you're kind of willing to overlook a lot of the narrative flaws because Boseman's performance is so riveting. And not just him, everybody else. Nelson Ellis as Bobby Bird takes on what would otherwise be a thankless role and brings a humanity to kind of the second banana. Jill Scott shows up as one of James Brown's wives. Dan Aykroyd puts in a performance that's not just standard Dan Aykroyd talking like he's from
Chicago. He made me nervous at first, though, because when he shows up in the beginning, you're like, uh-oh, that's exactly what I thought it was going to be with this. He just pops up this large Chicago accent. You're like, oh, no. But then he really, it's like a heartwarming performance, too, the relationship that his character had with Brown.
Yeah.
But this brings up the issue of the biopic and how do you do a good biopic? And it seems that taking on the from beginning to end entire life story of someone doesn't work usually in biopics. That if you focus in on one particular episode, a la Lincoln and his decision whether or not to free the slaves, that works.
Right. Well, I mean, I think sometimes it's an arc, and that was one of my biggest issues with the movie is when you want to know, he's such an interesting life. So when you want to know more about it, and then it just, that's it. You don't see any more.
It just gets too diffuse.
It's a letdown. So, and I think that they run into that a lot with the biopics. So, and sometimes they try to, it's a matter of the licensing, and for a movie, they want to make things look a little more glossy than it really is. It's, you know.
Well, one of the things this movie does that I think is really effective is, you know, even when he was still alive and even in his heyday, you watch films of James Brown and there's that, at least for some people, like there's that feeling in the back of your mind that, oh, there's something a little off with him maybe. Like maybe he's thinking in a, you know, right angles to everybody else. And the movie kind of uses that. There's these moments where he looks at the camera and he'll talk. And it's kind of in line with kind of the craziness you'd expect out of James Brown. And I think that's what helps set this movie above a lot of the cliches. And it mixes the timeline up. So it jumps back and forth.
And that's what I liked, what Tay Taylor had done. I liked that style. That was the stuff I did like with his style. It was different from most biopics because you saw, oh, I'm going to piece this here. And even though this might seem a little jarring to you, it'll make sense later on. That type of stuff he did I thought was really well. And Tay Taylor is great. I loved The Help. I thought The Help was a great, great film. And it was nice to see Octavia Spencer show up as well,
yeah,
too.
And Chadwick Boseman, he played Jackie Robinson in 42. Is he doomed now to play black luminaries?
That's an interesting question. I hope not. I think we've seen the range that he can bring to something. You know, his performance as Robinson is a very understated, very stoic performance for the most part. And you really only see Robinson as a character kind of lose his temper once or twice in 42. This one, the energy level that he brings, it's almost as if it was a different actor. And, you know, I think that between these two films, we've seen a really dramatic range that Boseman can do. So I'm excited to see him do other work.
And he also did the film Draft Day, which not a lot of people saw, but he was great in that movie. And it was just an athlete. He was a good guy. He was an athlete that it was a little outspoken, but it wasn't based off a true character. It was a guy on his own, and he brings something very special and unique to everything he does. And you're going to see a lot of this guy. The question is whether or not you're going to see him come Oscar season for this one.
Okay, speaking of biopics, Jamie Foxx has been cast to play Mike Tyson in the forthcoming biopic of Mike Tyson.
Ludicrous. Just ludicrous.
Why not just cast Mike Tyson to play himself?
Well, I mean,
he was great in The Hangover.
Well, but that's the thing is there's so much, and Mike Tyson has done his one man show for a very long time, and from what I'm hearing, they're going to CGI, I guess, they're going to use a lot of CGI to make the younger version. Mike Tyson, I love him to death, is one of the most interesting characters in the history of our time, but Jamie Foxx is a guy that's going to be able to bring that electric energy that Mike Tyson had. Mike Tyson's the youngest heavyweight champion of all time, 19 years old when he won the title. He had a very crazy, crazy life. It's a movie waiting to happen, and I think Jamie Foxx can embody all the nuttiness that Tyson is.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we see out of Jamie Foxx, you know, he'll take roles that don't require a lot. Some of his early roles are, you know, wisecracking Jamie Foxx, but we've seen him disappear into things.
Mm-hmm.
And he's absolutely the kind of actor that will leave his a standard persona behind. And
he played Ray Charles.
He plays Ray Charles.
Yeah. He was really good in Collateral,
too.
Great
in Collateral. So I think that if this actually happens, which I have my doubts that it actually will. Well, I mean, the first report was Tyson himself saying that Jamie Foxx is going to play.
But then he said Terrence Winter is going to write it, which to me, the Terrence Winter part of it is what makes me, because he, you know, Terrence Winter just did Wolf of Wall Street. So to have a guy writing that movie, that gets me excited because then you start to hear more about attaching directors. And I think it's very fun. I think it'll happen because the buzz has been pretty cool on it so far. Everybody's been talking about the story.
That could be really, I mean, look, if you're going to cast somebody as Mike Tyson, I think that Jamie Foxx is a great choice because I think he'll really bring some humanity to that role and be able to step outside of himself in a way that, I mean, it would be fun to see Tyson do that, but I don't think that you'd get the level of drama and gravitas that you would want in Tyson's story.
And Tyson's not a guy that you want to be working with for that long.
You never know what he's going to do.
Yeah,
right.
All right, Christian Harloff, co-host of the Schmoes No Movie
you got it. You almost had it.
I almost had it.
It's Schmoes No Movies podcast as well as AMC Movie Talk.
Okay, yeah, you just ID yourself. Matt Atchity, editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Warren Olney is here now. Who would play you in a biopic?
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a really good question. Let me think about that.
I think we should have some people weigh in. call in on our Facebook page. Who should play Warren Olney?
Well, maybe I'll do it myself.
I'm going to say a pre-Republican National Convention Clint Eastwood. Anyway, what's up at 1 o'clock?
Well, we're going to be talking about the extraordinary difficulty of covering the war in Gaza, in part because of the pressure that comes from both sides. Nobody believes what anybody else says, you know, so they attack the media, and how very difficult it is to thread your way through that. Among the people we'll be talking about with is Emily Harris, the extraordinary reporter for NPR, who has been in Gaza for all these days and who used to work right here.
Yeah,
who's
one of your producers.
She was one of my producers.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Well, she's a great reporter. Look forward to that conversation happening at 1 o'clock here on KCRW. And before that, Hollywood cranking out more and more huge action flicks, as we just talked about. And the marketing of them has gotten just as bloated. Why studios are complaining about spending $200 million a picture and why they won't spend a penny less. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Guardians of the Galaxy might not save the universe, but the Hollywood studios are hoping it'll save the summer. So far, the season's domestic box office has been disappointing, down around 20% compared to last year. And that's despite the fact that studios are spending huge sums of money to market their blockbusters. More money, by far, than ever before. According to The Hollywood Reporter, studios are now taking a hard look at their skyrocketing marketing costs. Mark Gill is a veteran movie marketer. He started at Columbia and was head of marketing at Miramax in its heyday, and now he's president of Millennium Films, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Well, my pleasure. And the Hollywood Reporter is saying that the marketing of a blockbuster has hit the $200 million mark. That's per picture. That just seems enormous. How did we get here?
Well, more than anything else, we got here out of greed and fear, which are the two dominant, you know, operating principles of Hollywood. So on the one hand, you have the opportunity when you get it right to gross $1 billion, and therefore a couple hundred million in marketing seems like a reasonable percentage. On the other hand, you also have the fear of losing one's job or not having a movie open as big as you hoped, and generally speaking, the press doesn't find out how much you spend on the marketing, and so there's no disincentive to keep the cost in line with the major studios. In fact, the incentives all run the other way toward, oh my God, we spent this much, let's just pour on another $10 or $20 million at the last minute as insurance.
Well, where does all this money go?
Mostly it goes to television advertising, and you know, everybody says, oh, TV is dead, or there's the social networks, or there's a thousand other ways to market movies, but unfortunately, only television has the reach that those blockbusters require, which is to say just massive rating points and ability to get consumers' eyeballs. I mean, there are problems with this, of course, like DVRs and are the people really watching, and et cetera, but there's no alternative, so it reminds me a little bit of Winston Churchill's aphorism about democracy, which is that it's just an appallingly awful system, but it's unfortunately better than all the others. So there's just no way, nobody's figured out how to solve this problem, and you know, when they do, it will save. Warner Brothers alone spends $2 billion a year on marketing its movies, so you can see where that money goes.
Wow. So why is it costing so much now to advertise on TV?
Well, television is, of course, less watched on the networks than ever before, but cable, of course, is more watched than ever. But I guess much more importantly, they have some form of a monopoly, which is there's just no other way to reach a broad group of people. And in particular for movie advertising, it's one thing to talk about something on the radio or in print or somewhere else, but mostly the way people decide whether something is good enough to get them out of the house is they want to see something. And even if that something is just 30 seconds worth, it needs to look good to get them out of the house.
Well, I guess the Hollywood studios, though, don't they bear some of the blame for this in the first place? Because they have this model where they need to open so huge on, what, 3,000 or 4,000 screens, and they have to do really well on the opening weekend.
Well, the studios are partly to blame, but it's also our culture. If you look at, you know, bestseller lists for books or, you know, any other cultural metric you want. Unfortunately, our attention span as a culture of consumers, and this is worldwide, not just the U.S., gets shorter and shorter and shorter. So that thing where you used to be able to have a movie that would sit in theaters for 52 weeks, as we did with Il Postino back in the day in the 90s, not happening anymore.
So this massive marketing that's happening, does that then wag the dog in the sense that it determines what kind of movies get made?
There's no question, because effectively what everybody is doing is betting their jobs on these biggest movies, because when they work, they are career savers, and they throw off so much cash that people's contracts get renewed. They also pay for the enormous overheads of the various studios that are putting these things together, which are all fairly gold-plated. They are something you can do if you're a big studio three or four times a year, so an enormous amount of focus in terms of energy for the movie and the marketing is put on those movies. But the alternative is, unfortunately, trying to sit in the middle and do a little bit less with less money and so on, and that really has fallen to the independents now. So I mean, so much of what I do for a living now, making movies like Olympus Has Fallen or The Expendables, is what studios used to do. They used to make movies for $40, $50, $60 million and market them for $30 or $40 million and pray that they would be good enough that you could actually succeed at that level. And now when we come to them with those movies, they yawn. They're not interested.
So Expendables, you make that on a pretty small budget. How do you market it?
Compared to the budgets of the studios, they're small, but it's still, $70 or $80 million, but it's not $200 million.
Right.
Lionsgate does our marketing in the U.S., and they're brilliant at it. And, again, they're a public company that has to be careful about how they spend their money, and they're very good at it. So effectively, what they're doing is not something that's enormously dissimilar from what the studios are doing. They're just doing it much more cost-consciously, so they don't have to have the most expensive, inefficient television program of the week. They don't have to have 10 of those. They don't have to have every billboard in New York City. They don't have to have all the gold-plated things the studios love to have. And what they find is not spending that extra chunk of money actually doesn't make a difference so long as the movie's decent.
Well, they also have their own TV shows, so can they just put the ads on their own TV shows?
Not really, because they're the producer of those shows, but they're not the network. So it's not one of those lovely efficiencies where you can just use your own stations to do that. So that wouldn't preclude one from advertising on a Mad Men show or something else, but it runs through a separate group, AMC Networks in that case. And AMC will, I promise you, still charge us plenty.
Yeah, I don't see Expendables 3 advertising on Mad Men somehow.
I don't either. It's a terrible, terrible example, but you get the point.
Yeah, I do. So, okay, Hollywood Reporter is saying that there's some soul searching going on and Hollywood studios wondering how they can rein in these costs.
I have heard that. I've been doing this for 25 years. I've heard that every 5 years for the last 25 years. I don't even remotely believe it.
That is
posturing for the press every time the word gets out how much money is being spent. Somebody has to say they're really worried about it, and then they don't do anything about it.
But why aren't they looking at lower cost avenues like sending an email to everybody with a trailer in it or, just advertising on Facebook, things like that?
Well, a lot of that is being done, and the percentage of marketing budget that gets spent on that stuff has gone up a lot. It used to be 1 or 2%, and then it became 8 or 10%, and now it sometimes can be 15%. But what they find is that those things are not the reason that people cite in exit polls as having gotten them to go to the movie. And it's very difficult to know if people are even, watching, paying attention, whatever. All that is done, nonetheless, as a sort of a support, but nobody wants to bet their career or a huge movie on trying to be an innovator in marketing. They're just not willing to do it. Too much at stake, and mostly, notably, their jobs. So they're just not going to do it.
Mark Gill, president of Millennium Films, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. By the way, Guardians of the Galaxy opened ginormous last night, $11 million.
Wow.
So that might actually save the summer after all. Normally, there's just to give you some sense of perspective, that's $2 or $3 million is considered quite good. So 11, I think, is maybe the biggest Thursday night ever. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So this is what happens, right? They make so much money on these things that then they go chase the, the brass ring again.
So there's going to be talking raccoons from here on out.
There we go. Thanks for your time.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
I say yes to talking animals.
I am a talking animal, technically. So, yeah, I can sign on for that. Not a raccoon. I do wear glasses, so maybe close enough.
Jolie Myers is here.
I am here.
Talking.
And I'm about to enter into 2 days of complete inaction. I wish it were 5 weeks, like the Congress, but alas, weekends are weekends. We did talk today about that congressional vacation and hence inaction. And we asked you all what you thought Congress should be tackling that they're not. Dean Bilal on Facebook says that he thinks Congress should focus on suing President Obama over his spate of executive actions. He says the president is promoting tyranny with all of those executive actions. Donna Ann Ward also weighed in on Facebook. She gave us a laundry list of things she'd like Congress to work on. How about taxing corporations and the wealthy, she says, cutting waste and fraud in government agencies, and oh hey, why not enforce existing laws and listen to constituents instead of big money? So lots of people talking about that, both on Twitter and Facebook. And if you all want to weigh in, feel free to do so. KCRW Press Play on Facebook, same on Twitter.
Yes, lots of ways to weigh in. You can also leave us a voicemail, which we will play at the end of the show on Monday, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Jolie Myers, have yourself a great weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And you all have a great weekend. Warren Olney and To The Point. Up next, I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you on Monday.
Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.